You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko shimino toku inwa, no mai haere mai ki te wai mo tēnei rā. Hello, welcome to the show for Wednesday, the 1st of February. I'm your host today, Shamina, and I'm joined in the studio by my producer, Dylan. So today on the show, we're speaking about how the government has funded broader access for the HPV vaccine. We're talking about how petrol prices have gone up this month. For Dear Science Today, we're talking about a botched science experiment in the UK and surprising venomous animals in Australia. We're also talking about a new reward system for the kokako bird. And also finally, we're talking about a local sustainable business in Auckland. If you want to let us know about any of your thoughts about the stuff that we talk about today on the show, please give us a call 093879 or give us a text on 5395. Let's get into it.
The Wire.
The government announced yesterday that boys as well as girls will now have funded access to the HPV vaccine Gardasil. The vaccine is commonly understood to protect against cervical cancer, but HPV can cause other types of cancer in both men and women. BFM reporter Ollie Clifton spoke to the director of Gay Men's Sexual Health Research Group at the University of Auckland, Peter Saxton, about this move to make the vaccine gender neutral.
The program's been expanded from girls only program from 9 up to 20 to a girls and boys program from ages 9 to 26 inclusive. So it's a really broad expansion in the existing program.
Is that fully funded? Is it going to be free to get the HPV vaccine?
Absolutely. I think some GPs might charge a small vaccine administration fee, but by and large, it'll be free through schools. And if you've missed out on the schools program, then you can visit your GP or sexual health service or family planning centre and get the vaccines there for free as well.
Right. So why has the change been made to introduce larger ages and now males?
Well, boys as well as girls can develop cancers related to HPV, and that includes cancers of the mouth, throat, penis and anus. So at the very simplest level, the expanded program is a fairer program. And it means that boys, whether they're straight or gay, can experience direct protection against HPV rather than having to wait on the vaccination status of their sexual partners. I guess the other appeal of the gender-neutral program is that it communicates some really positive values about shared responsibility and mutual care. So it's not just girls that are having to bear the burden of having to get vaccinated, but you can include boys in this program as well. So I think they're there. I think universally really positive values to communicate to young people and the community at large about ethics regarding shared responsibility and mutual care and sexual health and well-being generally.
Right. And why has this just been changed now? Like, why has it only come just this year?
Well, New Zealand's program amongst girls has had some success, but the vaccination rates are still low internationally. So this is an opportunity to, rather than work with just half the population, enrol both girls and boys in the vaccine program, hopefully get those rates well above 80%.
Is it an issue, do you think, on the fact that that's only come about now? Like, you know, for males like myself, who, you know, didn't get vaccinated in school, or males who are, you know, outside of that bracket now, is that an issue that we haven't been doing this already?
I think the original thinking is that girls were absolutely the priority because the burden of HPV-related cancers is highest for cervical cancer, the most common form of cancer caused by HPV, and girls certainly bore the highest burden of disease. But by vaccinating girls and getting the rates up really high, you can achieve what's called a herd immunity effect, which will provide indirect protection against boys. So people knew that boys also experienced HPV-related cancers, but I guess the full burden hasn't been fully appreciated until relatively recently. And one of the big risks is that we know that rates of mouth and throat cancer in men are rising, so it's a really timely development.
So there's this new vaccine as well as an upgraded version of the Gardasil vaccine. What does it cover that the old one doesn't?
Well, the original vaccine program, Gardasil, covered four HPV types, which includes types that cause genital and anal warts and types that causes cancer. The new vaccine is a non-avalent, so it covers nine types. That means that basically the vaccine is, has got a broader spectrum of protection, particularly in relation to cervical cancers, but it also protects against a range of other cancers, including ones that cause cancers in the mouth and throat and anus.
And so, again, for people that haven't had that vaccine, is there going to be some kind of program, or should they be concerned about getting the new one?
Well, I think the strongest message is that it's really important to take part in the school-based program. So if listeners have got children at school, that's most important that they receive the vaccine early, because vaccination prior to sexual activity confers the strongest protection. But it does also mean that even among people who are sexually active now or plan to be sexually active but have missed out on the school-based program, there's some really good reasons to seek vaccination now that it's free. So that includes people between the ages of 9 right up to 26, and that means that it's fully funded by government. And it also, as well as protecting against cancers, protects against genital warts, which are also incredibly awkward and inconvenient. So this is an opportunity to get a free vaccine which protects against a variety of cancers and also genital warts.
Right. So is this happening around the world as well as New Zealand, this kind of trend to vaccinate boys with HPV?
Well, Australia was certainly the first to expand vaccination beyond girls to include boys, and they've had incredible success. So they've almost eliminated genital warts, which are the earliest signs of HPV-related disease, among young people who received the vaccine. So internationally, there are certainly discussions about expanding it. New Zealand should be quite proud, however, because we're now the program with the widest coverage, not just boys, but also boys and girls from 9 to 26. So this really is an opportunity to put a lot of effort in getting our coverage rates up really high and seeking the ultimate goal, which is a reduction in HPV-related cancers.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
That was Peter Saxton from the Gay Men's Sexual Health Research Group at the University of Auckland, speaking about the government's announcement yesterday that boys as well as girls will now have funded access to the HPV vaccine. Up next, the AA monitors the fluctuations of the cost of petrol in New Zealand. This month, they say the national cost of petrol has risen 5 cents per litre to $2.08, despite no increase in commodity prices or a drop in the exchange rate. So why might this be, and what are the effects of this? I spoke to the AA Petrol Watch spokesperson, Mark Stockdale, about this, and started by asking him why the AA are alarmed about the increase.
Well, what we saw during January was that the national price of fuel rose by a total of 5 cents per litre. The AA monitors commodity price movements, exchange rates, those sorts of things. Those are the things that usually lead to an increase in fuel prices. But our monitoring showed that on this occasion, that didn't happen. In fact, the commodity price fell slightly and the exchange rate actually went up. And both of those things are good. And if anything, that means the price should have been coming down, not going up. And instead, they put the price up 5 cents. And we just don't understand what is the reason for that 5 cent increase. So the AA is asking fuel companies to explain to motorists why they felt the need to put prices up 5 cents.
Are you suspicious of any sort of particular reason why they might have done this?
Yes, we do have our suspicions, and I think we've got to acknowledge that there has been some very substantial price discounting going on around New Zealand. That's not new, that's been going on for quite a few years, but certainly over the Christmas New Year break there's been some really substantial discounting, and we've heard of prices being more than 40 cents below that national price. And the money for those discounts has to be funded from somewhere. At the prices that they're actually charging, in some cases they're selling that fuel at or below cost. So in order for them to sell at that price, they may have to make that up by charging a higher price in other parts of the country. So there's a bit of a cross-subsidy going on. And we think that might be one of the reasons for that 5 cent increase. That's our suspicion. We want the fuel companies to actually confirm whether that's the case or not. Certainly that cross-subsidy is the reason why margins have been climbing over the last few years, and we think it's due, it also explains that 5 cent increase. But let's hear it from the fuel companies.
In terms of figures, what are the sort of disparities between how much people are paying, and like where do those disparities sort of lie? Like where are people paying more and where are people paying less?
Sure, well, as I say, we have this thing that we call the national fuel price, which is, I guess, what the national fuel companies, the big brands that operate throughout the country, that's probably the price that they prefer to charge. you know, if they could get away with it. But then they have, you know, there's smaller competing brands like Gull who have lower overheads because a lot of their service stations are unmanned. So they're saving money by not employing staff. And they don't operate nationally. They only operate in, you know, Gull are only in the North Island. So the areas where prices are a lot lower due to, you know, the effect of having a low-cost operator like Gull dragging prices down, those are places like Northland, Auckland, Waikato, Bay of Plenty, Hawke's Bay, and as far south as Levin and Masterton. They've even just recently gone into Taranaki, so quite a lot of the North Island, you know, is benefiting from much lower fuel prices. The areas that are missing out are Wellington and all of the South Island. They don't benefit from that sort of price competition because there isn't a goal going in there, opening unmanned service stations and charging lower prices and forcing the other brands to then match those lower prices in those neighbourhoods. There is some price competition in Wellington and the South Island, so there is some competition, it does exist, but it's just not as widespread as in the North Island.
Right, I see. So they're kind of doing it to compete with those other sort of low-cost providers in places like Auckland and Northland. Or how would you respond to the argument that they're just, you know, being business savvy, you know, that they're doing this so that they can be competitive?
Well, I think that is one of the explanations. That's perfectly legitimate. That's a normal, healthy reaction to a free market. That is how other businesses would operate. It's not just a fuel company thing. We know that motorists are confused about fuel prices. The AA has surveyed its members, and they just don't understand why prices vary by 40 cents a litre or more in some places. They're suspicious of how much money the fuel companies are making. They think they're making large profits if they can sell fuel at $1.60-something in one place. They think they're making money on that, and then they see that they're selling fuel elsewhere at $2.09. They think they're making tons of money on that. So the public are confused and suspicious, and that is why the AA says that the fuel companies need to do a better job of explaining why their prices vary so much, why they set the prices that they set in different parts of the country, how the market works, how it is that they're responding to competition, and how they're actually selling fuel at those low prices. You know, tell the public, are they actually making money when they sell fuel at that price or not? And if they're not making money, explain to the public how it is that they can afford to sell fuel at those prices, i.e. by ensuring that they make money at service stations elsewhere in New Zealand that is charging a much higher price. Answer those questions that the public have and explain how the market works. You know, most New Zealanders own a car and buy fuel, so this is something that affects a hell of a lot of Kiwis, and they've got some genuine questions which the fuel companies need to actually provide some answers to.
Around, you know, up to 8,000 or 10,000.
Shit.
The Wire.
So I actually reached out this morning to some of the major petrol companies in New Zealand to get their comment on this. And in the last hour, I heard back from BP spokesperson Shelley Brady, who sent me a written statement. So Brady said, first of all, it's important to note that roughly half of the BP-branded stores operating in New Zealand are independently owned and operated by local business people who set their own retail prices and manage their own operations. As for the company-owned stores around the country, she said that although the Kiwi dollar is strong at the moment, they've actually seen some increases in the commodity price of refined products. So that's one of the reasons for the increase, and also that there are other factors that go into deciding the national price, such as taxes, shipping costs and local operating costs. So she also said, like many other retail businesses, BP will independently change their prices when and where they can to ensure competitiveness in the markets in which they operate. So she did confirm they do undertake regional discounting in parts of New Zealand like Auckland, but she didn't confirm whether this is actually the reason behind the 5 cent increase or not. So now we'll be back after a quick break with Dear Science.
I get. just need a break. What do I get? What do I get?
Guys, I've been scavenging in the forest all day and I... Wait, what? You're eating burgers? Where'd you get the meat? Yummy. Where's Piggy? My God, you're eating Piggy, aren't you? You've only been stuck on this island for 2 hours and already you've turned to savagery. How could you? I weep for this loss of innocence, for the darkness in your heart.
Oh, chill out, Dickie. These are from Lord of the Fries. They're vegetarians.
Yeah, turns out this isn't an island at all. We're just in Myers Park.
Oh. Is it chip?
Lord of the Fries is your new favourite purveyor of delicious, ethical fast food that just happens to be vegetarian and vegan too if you want. Burgers, hot dogs, sides and of course fries in all manner of delicious sauces. Get all the info and the full menu from lordofthefries.co.nz and get you some from St. Kevin's Arcade or 1 Queen Street.
Hi, you've reached Tally Kiwi Nesis, New Zealand's number one psychic hotline. Please hold the line for your specially selected clairvoyant.
Hello, this is Susan. What can I foresee for you?
Hi, I was hoping you could tell me what the traffic is going to be like on New North Road this afternoon.
Right, let me just see. Okay, ooh, it's not looking good.
Really? Your psychic powers are telling you that?
My psychic powers? Dude, you're driving a car in Auckland. Of course you're going to get stuck in traffic.
There are easier ways to get the juice on your forthcoming traffic woes, the best being the 95BFM traffic report. Every weekday on Breakfast and Drive, we'll let you know which streets are arse to ankle and which roads are flowing free. The 95BFM traffic report, proudly brought to you by Scootling, your key to unparalleled freedom with a range of style and scooters and mopeds to ease all your congestion woes. Visit them at 310 Great North Road and online at scootling.co.nz, the spiritual homeland of city movement.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
Before the break, you heard What Do I Get from the Buzzcocks. Now it is time for this.
Science is interesting, and if you don't agree, you can fuck off.
Yes, it is time for Dear Science. So today, AUT Professor of Chemistry Alan Blackman is back again for another week before Steve Poynting returns next week. So how are you doing, Alan?
I'm doing very well, thanks, Shamina.
Awesome. So we're starting off with a story about a botched lab experiment at a UK university where two students were given a dose of caffeine equivalent to 300 cups of coffee.
Yes, indeed they were. And this one has made the news last week quite substantially. So the guts of it was, this was a university in England, Northumbria University. It was a sports science undergraduate class, and what they were doing was looking at the effect of caffeine on sort of exercise performance. And so basically the kids would dose up on caffeine prior to the lab, and then they go in and, I don't know, run on a treadmill or whatever you do in these sorts of things. and measure their performance sort of before and after the ingestion of caffeine. So the way they did it was to dissolve the caffeine in orange juice and get that down you, and away you go. So what they were meant to do was to put in about 300 milligrams or 0.3 of a gram of caffeine into the orange juice, and that's the equivalent to about 3 cups of coffee, so three decent hits of caffeine. Somebody did a miscalculation. Apparently they did the calculation on a mobile phone calculator, apparently, and they got it wrong, and instead of 0.3 of a gram, they put in 30 grams. Okay, so that's the equivalent of 300 cups of coffee all at once.
Wow. Important to get that decimal place right.
Oh, God. Yeah, well, you know, somebody should have checked the calculations, number one. So what happened as a result of this is that these two unfortunate guys, who, according to the doctors, were fit and healthy, and if they weren't, they might have died.
Wow.
Ended up in hospital for a week, severe palpitations, blurred vision, dizziness, all of that sort of stuff. They had to go on dialysis to get the stuff out of their system. There have been reports of caffeine being fatal at as low as a 12-gram dose and also an 18-gram dose. So these guys had 30 grams. They were extraordinarily lucky to get away with this. So, and this happened in 2015, and the reason that it's only just sort of come out now is that the court case that resulted from this has just come through with a judgment of about $690,000 against the university, who said that they were very sorry and they won't do it again. But I talk to my students over and over and over again about the importance of numbers and about the importance of figuring out whether a number is sort of in the right ballpark or not. If you go and weigh out 30 grams of caffeine, that's an awful lot. It's a big pile of a white powder, and you'd think they might have thought, ooh, hang on, that looks like quite a bit. And apparently caffeine's not very soluble in water. You can only get about sort of a couple of grams of caffeine in 100 mils. So
there would have been like big chunks kind of
you would imagine,
floating
yeah,
in there.
Yeah, yeah. So it's not overly soluble. So where was the control there? You know, what were the lab demonstrators doing, or why did it come to this? And, you know, basically unsupervised students giving each other sort of powders in a laboratory. It's really, really not good. It's just not safe, and that's been amply demonstrated, I guess. So
for sure, yeah.
And the university is a lot poorer. So yeah. and that's the thing. The people who bear the ultimate responsibility is basically the university. You know, they're essentially under the health and safety legislation responsible for the safety of all of their students. So mm-hmm. if anybody does make a stuff up like that, then ultimately it's the higher ups who end up being responsible. Although in New Zealand, I'm not sure that's necessarily the case anymore. I think they've just made some changes a couple of years ago, which puts the responsibility sort of on the direct supervisors rather than the ultimate people at the top. So,
oh, really?
So we have to watch out for these sorts of things. So that's why in laboratories and everything, we're always really, really careful and make sure students don't do stupid things like they did here. So.
Yeah, right. Well, because I was going to say, aren't there, you know, so much scientific research and academic research kind of almost prides itself on the amount of like checks and balances and, you know, things being peer reviewed and always having like a second and third sort of pair of eyes going over something. So like, how did this?
Well, you can make damn sure now that it will be, you know, every university and probably around the world, I guess, will have taken notice of this. And people will be checking things now. You can be very, very, very sure of that. So it's unlikely, hopefully, that this sort of thing will happen again, but sadly, you never know.
So has the university just said, okay, so this was just like a fatal sort of error on the part of these students, or have they kind of said, given any other sort of reasons as to...
Well, as it is with court cases, you know, unless you're there in the court, you never hear the full story, seemingly, and those are the details that I could glean from the net. There's probably much more to this than what we're hearing, so that might come out in the fullness of time. I don't know yet, but mm-hmm. it would be interesting to find out exactly how the hell it happened.
Yeah, for sure. So. Have we seen anything else like this before? Or
sadly, there's a very famous case in chemistry, unfortunately, from about 10 years ago, where a female student, an undergraduate student in one of the labs in the States, was using a chemical that catches fire spontaneously if it hits air. So you've got to be very, very careful in your use of it, and you've got to be very experienced. And she was using a syringe. The end popped out of the syringe. The stuff caught fire. She wasn't wearing a lab coat. Sadly, she burned to death.
Wow.
And the supervisor, her laboratory supervisor, was deemed liable. Basically, the university sort of said, no, we're not going to support you. And so the supervisor had to carry the can for that, and he went to court. And I can't remember the exact judgment, but he might have got something like it was not guilty, but he had to be supervised or something for X period of time and pay, you know, however many thousands of dollars or whatever. But and again, you could argue in that case, sadly, it was the student's fault because she'd been shown how to do this sort of stuff. She wasn't working under supervision, and she wasn't wearing a lab coat. That was the thing. Had she been wearing a lab coat, then she may not have died. The burns might not have been so bad. But it does happen. It's infrequent. And again, actually, there was an explosion in a lab in Hawaii a couple of years ago, and the court case just is ongoing with that. I think the student was using high pressure hydrogen, and there was a spark. Something wasn't earthed properly, and she lost an arm. And so she's now suing the university there as well. So, as I say, you know, these things do happen. They're accidents, but possibly they're avoidable. But you know, who knows?
Yeah. So, I guess also, though, the thing is that it's more surprising that they're happening now. I mean, I feel like, you know, 10, 20, 30, 40 years ago, when you heard about all those sort of like questionable sort of ethical experiments done, like the Stanford experiment, or when some scientists were retreating monkeys and growing them up as humans, like sort of very dodgy, sort of like questionably, exactly. But I feel like nowadays, I mean, speaking from doing my own very rigorous ethics application for research, where I was just interviewing somebody, that it just surprises me that still, like, there can be just major oversights like this.
Yeah, well, I guess ethics, dare I say it, ethics doesn't play a large role in chemistry. We don't have to get ethics approval for experiments and stuff.
Right.
We have to make sure that we're working under safe conditions, and we have to make sure the students are informed of the possible dangers with anything that they're working with. So, I think you're probably right. I think things were probably a little bit faster and looser way back 30, 40 years ago, certainly in chemistry as well. But with all the legislation nowadays, you know, you've got to fill out so many damn forms before you can fill a test tube. So
yeah, for sure. And so next up, we were talking about a surprise animal that tops the list of the most deadly venomous creatures in Australia. So tell me about this.
Absolutely. So listeners, have a guess. Which one do you think is the most dangerous venomous animal in Australia? The one that's caused the most deaths over the period 2000 to 2013? It is the bee.
Yeah, that surprised me. That really surprised me. That would have not been in my top, like, 10 guesses, maybe.
Indeed. So bees and wasps had a total of 27 fatalities over that 13-year period. 25 bees and 2 wasps. And around about 12,000 hospital admissions as a result of bee stings and wasp stings, so with 27 fatalities. Spiders had about 11,000 hospital admissions. I didn't see anything about the fatalities for that. But you might have thought snakes or something like that, perhaps. They had about 6,000 admissions and also around about 27 fatalities. So thereby, you know, in terms of fatalities, they're the same, but in terms of hospital admissions, bees are much more dangerous. So you would think that country that's full of nasty, nasty things that can kill you, you know, snakes, spiders, you would think would be top of the list, but they certainly weren't. Box jellyfish, for example, the stingers, as they call them, over there only accounted for 3 fatalities, which surprised me. I thought that they were much worse than that. Ticks and ants killed 5 people. Yeah, ticks, wow. Ticks I can understand because they carry Lyme disease, but ants? You get killed by
killer ants.
That's not good.
Luckily, we don't have any killer ants in New Zealand, I don't think.
Not that we know of.
Not that we know of.
So it's interesting to compare the venomous animals with the non-venomous animals. So again, Australia renowned for sharks and crocodiles. So again, over that time period, we had 26 shark fatalities, so the bees beat the sharks.
Yeah.
We had 19 crocodile fatalities, And top of the list for the animal that killed most people is, have a guess.
Wait, so this is a
in Australia. This is the non-venomous animal.
The non-venomous animal. Gosh.
What caused the most deaths?
A human.
Nope. Okay, call yourself animal. Not counting humans. Yeah.
I don't know. I've gone blank. You got to tell me.
The horse. 74 people killed by horses.
So just like being kicked off the back of a horse,
or falling off, or whatever. Yeah. Yep. So quite surprising. So beware of horses.
Yeah, for sure. So back just to backtrack a bit to the bees though, I'm wondering, is this just like a numbers thing because there's way more bees than perhaps like some other venomous animals? Is it kind of down to that?
I guess that would play a part, I suppose. There's a hell of a lot more bees than there are snakes. So yeah, I think that's probably a fair assumption.
Mm-hmm.
What they also found, and this is just in a recently published paper in a journal called A Journal of Internal Medicine from the University of Melbourne. And they found that, it's probably not too surprising anyway, that like snake bites, etc., don't happen out in the bush. They happen in cities. So they're in your backyard and everything
right.
like that. So
the majority
of hospitalizations and fatalities came from bites in populated areas. So kind of surprising.
Yeah, I guess in some ways it makes sense because if a snake is in an environment that they're kind of, you know,
there are a lot of people, yeah.
Yeah, but they're not, that you know, getting chances agitated and it's not, you know, like then that sort of thing might be more possible. And I'm also wondering as well, like, so why, because bees are, I don't know, why are bees, why would they sting somebody? It's because people are doing dumb stuff or?
Well, again, why do bees sting people? Well, we're just having a house renovated at the moment. We found 3 beehives in the roof. So, you know, they.
Whoa, okay. 3?
3, oh, yes. Okay. Luckily they're all dead. So, I guess, you know, they are around people, and if you go disturbing them, they're going to sting you. And again, the reason that people die from this is sort of anaphylactic shock. So they've got allergies.
Just reacted really badly to it.
Yeah. So on their own, they don't kill you. But, you know, if you're unluckily allergic to such things, then it can cause death.
Yeah, true. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I guess I always, with, like, bees and wasps, I kind of, like, you think, like, okay, you just got to be, like, live harmoniously with the bees and the wasps, that you just, if you I don't know, I feel like if something comes near you when you're sitting down or something, if you just like sit real still, then you're probably going to be okay. Maybe that's not a very scientific sort of philosophy behind that, but I feel like, I don't know, if you kind of proactively kind of
The Buddhist way, sort of thing.
Yeah, yeah. I suppose so. Yeah, but if you're like climbing a tree and you might shake a branch, then, you know, probably not the best thing to do to protect oneself against such things.
Yeah, well, you can't live harmoniously with wasps. They're bastards. Nasty things. Kill them all.
Bring out the mortine.
Yeah.
On that note, what's the third thing that you have for us today?
Okay, a little bit of chemistry for you all, again, because I'm a chemist. So we talk about 3 states of matter, solid, liquid, gas. Okay, so that's the first thing you get taught in chemistry at high school. And you get taught that hydrogen is a gas, for example. So it's a colourless gas, it's lighter than air, all of that sort of stuff. However, hydrogen can also be a liquid if you cool it down enough. And if you cool it down even further, then you can make it a solid. So you've got to go really, really cold, obviously, to get it to be a solid. So you've got to go sort of minus 200 and whatever. You know, we were talking about temperatures the other day.
Yeah.
And what happens if you simultaneously cool hydrogen and put an enormous pressure on it is that you can potentially turn it into a metal. Now, we don't normally think of hydrogen as being a metal. However, about 80 years ago, it was predicted that hydrogen at very, very low temperature and very, very high pressure should exist as a metal. And so people have been trying to do this over the last 80 years. Obviously, technologically, it's a big challenge. You need extraordinarily high pressures. You need very, very cold temperatures. So this team at Harvard have just reported that they have succeeded, apparently, in making hydrogen into a metal. And you might think, well, so what? Well, number one, it satisfies the prediction from 80 years ago, and that's what science is all about, making predictions and then experimentally finding out whether those predictions are true. And secondly, if this turns out to be true, then metallic hydrogen could be what is called a superconductor or a no-resistance superconductor. And that's very, very important in things like electricity transmission, for example. We lose heaps of energy transmitting electricity because the wires are resistant. They have resistance, just like water flowing through a pipe. There's resistance to water flowing through a pipe, so you get pressure drop. Same thing with electricity. However, there are some remarkable substances which can transmit electricity, heat, etc., with absolutely no loss, and these are called superconductors.
Cool.
And
okay.
At the moment, they only exist at very, very, very low temperatures. They think that if you can make metallic hydrogen, and the pressure that you need is about 5 million Earth atmospheres, and the temperature is minus 270 degrees, so you do this in a big diamond anvil press. And they think that if you can make metallic hydrogen, once you take the pressure off it, it'll remain as metallic hydrogen, and therefore you might be able to use this as a superconductor. So it's kind of cool, you know. It's a little bit of chemistry, and again, it's just nice because of the fact that it was predicted all those years ago, and now has possibly been experimentally verified. There's a little bit of angst out there, I guess, in the community. One person called it complete garbage, another scientist. So
why?
He reckoned that the experimental details that were given in the paper that it was published in were not sufficient to be able to replicate it. So he doesn't necessarily believe that they've done it. So
I see.
All that this will do is spur further research into it and people going on and trying to replicate it under the experimental conditions that these guys have used. So, you know, the first isolation of metallic hydrogen. Kind of cool.
And so why did people all those years ago predict hydrogen other than another element to be able to be turned into a metal?
Very good question, which I'm not sure I actually know the answer to. What you need in order for something to behave as a metal, the one thing is free electrons. Now, we're getting into the chemistry side of things here, but atoms are made up of nuclei and electrons, okay?
Yeah.
And normally you think about the electrons whizzing around the nucleus, okay? Mm-hmm. They're stuck to a particular nucleus. In metals, they're not. They're free to roam all around. So you've got your nuclei of all the atoms in the metal and all the electrons, what we call a sea of electrons, and they're floating around. They're not associated with any particular nucleus, and that is why metals conduct. It's why they conduct electricity, conduct heat. It's why they're shiny, is this fact that the electrons can move freely. In normal hydrogen, they can't do that, but they showed that potentially that could happen, but you'd need to alter the molecular structure essentially of hydrogen, and the one way of doing that is extreme pressures, so that you're squeezing the molecules together so much that they start behaving weirdly, and that the electrons, instead of being associated with particular nuclei, can float around and behave like a metal. So
cool.
So theory versus experiment, which, as I say, is what science is all about.
And so they have to keep this metallic hydrogen at a low sort of temperature to be able to for it to remain, or
at the moment they think they do, but again, some of the predictions say that that might be what is called metastable, that once you get it, it might hang around for long enough that you can do some stuff with it once you warm it up and take the pressure off. They don't know that yet, but that'll be the subject of future studies for surely.
Awesome. Cool. So, well, thank you for joining us for another week, Alan.
Not a problem, Shemina. Thank you.
Yeah, it's been awesome having you for the past 3 weeks, and hope to chat to you again sometime.
Cool. Thanks very much.
Awesome.
That was Dear Science.
Life's too short for bad selectors, so improve your musical background with From the Crate. Every Thursday on BFM Breakfast, we'll treat you to a few pieces of delicious wax from Southbound Records. From the Crate, 9:15 every Thursday morning on BFM Breakfast with me, Troy. Thanks to Southbound Records, the largest range of new vinyl in New Zealand at 132 Simon Street and online.
Around, you know, up to 8,000 or 10,000.
Shit.
The Wire.
The South Island Kakako Charitable Trust has introduced a new reward system. If anyone can provide definitive proof that the South Island Kakako still exists, the trust will pay them out $5,000. The bird was thought to be extinct, but wavering evidence over the last decade has suggested that the bird may well be frolicking within the South Island bushlands. I spoke to Jeff Reed, a photographer and environmentalist who was determined to find the South Island Kakako. We'll find out more about the Charitable Trust's incentives and the likelihood of tracking down a South Island Kakako.
The trust has put out a $5,000 reward for anyone that can bring in definitive evidence of Kukaku still in existence.
By definitive proof, what defines that?
Well, what we really need is a photograph. At the moment, we get in a lot of reports from all over the South Island, mainly on the West Coast. You know, recordings of people hearing the bird, seeing the bird, but, you know, it doesn't quite cut the mustard. What we really need is a photograph so we can prove that the bird's still out there.
What kind of sparked your interest for this bird itself?
Yeah, I'd come across some people that had spent a lot of time in the forest looking for this bird, and I'd also heard of a lot of reports, some recent, some obviously not so recent, and I just wanted to make up my own mind. And, you know, I spent the last sort of 2 years up and down the West Coast, on and off, going in and out of the bush, checking out certain reports and hearing it come from people that didn't really have much of a bird background, but keen observers, you know, hunters or farmers, hikers, and hearing their experiences, which is really interesting, especially when you talk to someone that doesn't have a deep understanding of Kukaku at all. And yeah, I guess I made up my own mind, and I was lucky enough to have a couple of experiences in the last sort of 2 years, which has made me pretty convinced and motivated me to support the trust and to get people involved in this campaign and to be the eyes and the ears of the trust to hopefully we can land a photograph.
So you'll be on the hunt for the bounty, for the bird?
Yeah. Well, the hunt's ongoing, man.
And have you ever heard the bird or seen any droppings or any kind of signs of life that have, kept your interest going?
Yeah, so I've had, a couple of experiences where I've heard birds in areas where there have been reports. Yeah, very convincing. And, I can't wait to get back into the bush.
What attributed to the decline of the South Island Kukaku in the first place, do you know?
Well, we've got that problem in New Zealand with introduced predators, introduced grazing animals as well, like possums. And obviously deforestation, habitat loss was a massive one. The whole east coast of the South Island, all that lowland forest had been cleared.
From what we know, was the South Island Kukaku abundant prior to that?
I don't think so. Some of the reports from the early days, like early 1800s, from, the bird hunters, they even talk about the bird as being really shy and, quite uncommon in the forest, unlike the North Island Kukaku. So there could be a potential that it's got, different behaviour, maybe different food habits. It's always sort of been relatively uncommon, if you look back at the reports.
What do you think the best chances of seeing one of these birds could be, without obviously giving away spot X, of course?
Well, could be anywhere from, the top of Marlborough down the west coast, in and out of all that native forest, down to Stewart Island. But the best locations we could have the most success would be in forests that have had ongoing predator control, really good vegetation, the forests that have had really good possum control over the years, and even rat control.
How many hours do you think you've spent looking for this bird?
Ooh, I wasn't counting, but I don't know.
Obviously goes beyond what you can count then.
Well, I've got nothing up against some of the older fellows that have spent a whole lifetime on this, so I'm still young and still keen to get out there more,
Is there much of a youth community looking for this bird, or is it mainly older people who know?
Not really. That's why the trust is focused on, encouraging the public to get out there and have a look for it. In the past, the trust has focused on more priority sites, where the most likely ones are, and they've put people on the ground and fundraised to get food and, all sorts of equipment like sound recording gear and self-setting camera traps, putting models up in trees and, leaving them for 3 month periods, coming back and checking all the data, and also getting hundreds of hours of audio recordings. But there's only so much that a trust can do with limited resources. So, we've put it out to the public. Search is alive. And, we really look forward to paying someone out a reward if they can get that evidence.
So all someone has to do is get a photo of the bird and then send it in. What happens after that?
So the trust will appraise any evidence received and submit the most compelling evidence into, an independent expert analysis. But the reward will be paid out once a panel of New Zealand ornithologists, agree on its survival. So a photograph would be the ultimate. There's only so much recordings can take us where, at the end of the day, tuis or other birds can mimic other birds. Even Kukaku can copy tuis, so it does get quite tricky when we are playing around with bird recordings.
Yeah, and I guess people are pretty good at Photoshop these days as well, so you got to look out for that.
Yeah, of course. A video would be ideal.
Yeah, yeah, sweet.
One thing that we do have is thousands and thousands of hours of audio data from, you know, hot sites, we call them, all around the South Island. And, you know, it takes someone to go through that data and go through every single minute of it and look at the sound waves and pick out which frequencies are likely to be kōkako and then go through and review all those bits of, all those sound clips. And this is a massive job and it takes thousands of hours. So we're quite excited that there could be some technology coming out soon that can, you know, automatically go through and do that and, yeah, automize it.
Yeah, that'd be cool.
Yeah, but it just comes down to funding, you know. Like, there's all sorts that we could do if we had the resources, and at the moment it's pretty skint on the ground.
If any of the listeners are keen on getting involved with the trust, where do they go to?
So if you are interested in getting out and becoming part of the search, it'd be great if you could check out our website, southislandkōkako.org. You know, if you're a keen hunter or a keen hiker or, you know, just a keen trapper, these are the things to look out for. A blue-grey bird, smaller than a pigeon, bigger than a tui. The sound of a kōkako will stop anyone in their tracks. It's a beautiful, melancholy, organ-like flute call, quite clear and crisp, and it's actually kind of haunting, so you'll hear it throughout the forest. Make sure you've got a device ready or a camera or something ready to go in case you do have an experience. But the observation is key. We're looking out for orange wattles underneath the bill and, yeah, a sort of hopping, running type movement of the bird. It is flightless, but it can glide. So typically it'll hop through the branches sort of like a squirrel and glide across from one tree to another or glide down the canopy.
That was The Wire.
Yep, so that wraps up the end of this week's show. Unfortunately, because of our minor technical difficulties earlier, we ran out of time to play our final interview about an awesome local design practice called Resilio. But please tune in next week because we will play it then. But anyway, thank you to everybody who spoke with us for the show today. Jeff Reed, Alan Blackman, Peter Saxton and Mark Stockdale. Thank you very much to my producer Dylan for helping me out this week, and thank you all for tuning in. We'll be back again next week. Have a great afternoon.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.